The short summary is that I've been doing newspapers and journals and making up stuff in my notebook since I was about 10.
Cool.
Yeah. And then I started doing more of that, but then when I went to college, I kind of got away from it and actually and worked with real people on college magazines and stuff rather than just stuff in my notebooks. That eventually led to me knowing enough people to do a journal. And so in 1995, which is my favorite story about this, I decided, okay, well, I'm not in school anymore, but I know a bunch of people who write and stuff, and we have gatherings like this gathering is sourced in those gatherings. I went out and bought a Canon desktop photocopier for $500. $500 now would get you, I don't know what compared to then, but this was like just a, it was a square, let me get it in the camera. It was a little square photocopier. You lift up the lid and it goes, yeah,
Yeah.
technology. And so the first Sunnicle, which was 59 issues ago, was very much a sort of a cut and paste typewriter affair. There was no computers involved, just a little Canon photocopier.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this 15 years later, this was made with so many different programs. I can't even list them all. But I think that in some ways it still is the same production. It's just fancier.
Punched up enthusiasm. Blossoms sing up a storm. Rowdy, ridiculous. Wooden chimes speak. New day approaches. Welcome, stranger. A polar bear walked onto my canvas with frozen tundra words. We understood. Fear of cold. Crazy in heat. I've outlived my ecology. That was a menopause haiku. Right. Absolute zen. Before enlightenment, baked cookies. After, baked cookies. Oxygenated mind. Trips over obstacles. No matter. Nothing real. Unfettered exploration. Alone is spectacular. Together is bliss.
I love those last two lines.
And why seven crows flying and cawing, drawing pictures of hidden landscapes? Why crows? Why not hawks and eagles? Or pigeons and doves. Why crows? Why do I wait for crows to describe the morning?
Where did that come from?
Crows in the morning.
Yeah.
I wait for them. When I bike to school, there are crows in the field, and I wait to see what's new, and they let me know.
You're funny.
I wouldn't make these things up.
Well, I don't see how you could. Do you
Okay,
think
one more thing.
do you
What?
get do you get a sense that they do you get a sense that they recognize you in some crow kind of way?
No, they don't give a shit.
Yeah, they don't care. It
Anyone could have been there. It happened to be me.
happened. Okay, so they're busy being crows.
They really have their own mind set
Yeah.
on their own thing. Yeah. Okay, this is the last one of mine.
Okay.
Replay, replay, replay. No game, but only game. Lock her up. No need for key. No one understands. Both sides play. All sides deadly serious. Don't look. Must look, but not now. Never now. Lock her up. One day it'll somehow fade away, but not now. Never now. Lock her up.
This is from a little zine called Tippy Must Die.
Sounds good.
Yes. And this is entitled Whatever Happened To? Whatever happened to Beaker from The Muppet Show? I saw him in a porno movie doing Tori Welles. Me, 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 he said. Me, 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 she moaned. He's got a tattoo of a snake on his pelvis, doing her in the slow-mo while the cheesy funka-funka music was throbbing in the back. Yet, like all Muppets, he had no nipples, just a smooth, puffy, foam rubber chest. How did this happen? When Henson died, things just got weird, Beaker seemed to say. Of course, the only thing he actually said was, me, me, me. But we could tell by his eyes what he meant. Beaker, like the rest of the cast, lost track of Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, but heard a rumor that Honeydew was slain in a drive-by shooting. One can only speculate whether crack cocaine was involved. Sorry about that.
All right.
Do you know that I'm a puppeteer?
Oh, well, then, there you go. That eight strikes home.
So do you know any rumors about what happened in it? Can you confirm the crack cocaine thing?
No, but I do agree about the nipple situation.
Okay, so this is a poem by my friend Rick Amante, who lives in Massachusetts. He rewrote this recently. I don't know how it changed, but this is a poem he wrote a long time ago. He used to work at a hardware store, and he turned it into a really sublime kind of thing. At John's Hardware. John's been married to Kate for 60 years. Today she lies in the hospital dallying with mortality. It scares and shatters him, and his eyes turn inward, grow spectral and glossy, as he confides in me by a pegboard of keys. It's coming out black like old motor oil. They ever hooked up to a bag of something that looks like wallpaper paste. I've seen a lot and given death some thought. Ah, Christ, I don't know. I guess it's her time now, my time soon. They say it all makes sense, but why isn't it as simple and clean as the task right here before us? Blank lined up to original, lever guided down, steel cut, burrs filed, a sure thing, a new key.
Okay, again from the legendary Tippy Must Die. This will only take about... This is called Fast Food and Religion Abridged. I looked down at my hands and saw stigmata, but then realized it was just a leaky burrito supreme. Again, I should have apologized in advance.
Dance hall orphans. Not when hanging onto the running boards of four-cylinder Fords, or when painting in bright colors in the middle of the night, or when creeping with broken bones beneath blow-hung eaves, pitched against the winter dome, but now, all at once, that he realizes his best years are now gone. There were days of reflection and other days, more ragged and with frayed ends, when he took photographs of wallflower women whose pale hands held bouquets of their own flowers. Days when the fires rose around them and she said, stand and deliver, while he thought about the Savior. They made a record once when he was 24, but he ain't 24 anymore. He is me and she is you, caught in a moment of revelation, and these things of which we seem constitute us, the proud nomads. Endless hopers laying down on the salty rails like godfathers of the railroad.
My mini music series is now to its sixth series, which I've decided is going to run for the next several years because it's simpler that way. Series begins with a phrase that came into my head at some point. Black ink, psychedelia, trying to love the world near and far. Seems to sum up, that's my creed. Black ink and psychedelia. First few poems, I got to thinking about these flowers that we get and we put on the table, and then eventually they wither and we put them in the box outside. I was thinking about mortality and trying to get and grappling with it by way of these flowers. By way of grappling with them and also grappling with the ideas that they were making me think about. Two blooms. Cut roots for a sweet touch, living on water and packets of fresh. I wanted to cross the line, wanted to know. What did you see? Rooted to the earth. What did you see later in that vase? Then one of you sagged. Let go. Was it hard? I brought you to the empty flower box of soil, just outside the window with the vase. Closed the curtain against your remain. Some of your petals discovered still inside. I cringed, but want to know better than this. The other remains inside, in the vase. Not yet, but soon. I speak of this to no one. It's mine. This. I'm loving you. I'm mourning for you. I listen around me to what men say of death, and I think of you. Nothing learned yet. A hunger. A terror. Gone is gone. Your petals don't fall like the others, but you burst from within as you droop from without. Bloom gone, yes, I know, and the strange fact of birthday flowers now on the same table. And through the window where the other is gone. How gone is gone is gone. Shifts shifting. Something. A deep something I cannot or will not call dream or music or want. This world is not ours. Every last bloom of us falls, always has, always will. Maybe so. Maybe better so. What then? An earthquake hit an island yesterday. Today that girl smiled at him and one hit his heart. Every shift contacts every other shift. The bodies underneath rubble. How she moves beneath him in his dreams. That unsentimental. Remain of remain. When you finally joined the other, I was clumsy and your petals fell scattered to the floor. I delivered the remain of your remain to the flower box. A lean, a toss, a departure. Your bloom went elsewhere, like the light after dusk goes. Raw from ours. The hungers within will to surround the world in flesh or words or the gross massings of godmongers, how a few men can touch the map and decide. Mountains decide our fates eventually, what the seas less willing yield, how the skies change in color and the air in subtleties, telling not a few men now, but all here and hereon how we've done. So when I look at you, my love, think of what you are by soul and spirit, how the few men are shifting maps we reside, and how the mountains will tend the world it's unfolding when these men lie again simple in her arms. I think what we do matters, and matters, and very much matters, and little and less, and none at all. The glaring one's face, the music of an excited night, the ways flesh insists to its pleasures, the ways heart shape these further still. I am left half exposed and crying, half hidden, crouched close, in how much I love the world and how much I love you. Seas is sort of a kind of a little disaster, a calamity, but you know.
It's universal.
Yeah. I've become almost allegorish lately in a couple of poems. I have some environmental poems, almost like Gary Snyder or something. Yeah. This one's called Get Clean or Die Trying.
That sounds like Gary Snyder.
Another eruption, the earth wordless by her live fury. I believe her. I believe you. You are furious. Human bodies live on your body and abuse it. Eat and breathe of it and abuse it. And more eat and breathe of it and abuse it. Reach into my heart, mother, my true mother, the one who birthed and cares for my kind. Reach into my heart, mother, deeper than any has ever known me. Feel how raw, how twisted in music and want and brotherhood for all, how angry, how like your fury is mine. I am small, but I am like you. I do not know of men's gods and idols this deep in me. Little reaches me but music of breath, of beat, of dream. And I wish to service you as you service me from this simple core and terminus. Let me sing and better know how to sing. Sing for you by gesture to all. For all that you love, let me be plainly one of your musics. Let this power between us unbraid.
This is a National Lampoon take on Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yeah, yeah,
1969.
Sure.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So, like I say, I think National Lampoon is pretty new at that point in time. And some of the language they really use in here is actually pretty fun.
Yeah.
Makes you think that these persons are actually, they did go to school.
Uh-huh.
Right. But maybe they just took some English classes and like throwing that shit around.
Right. Hard to tell sometimes.
I mean, when somebody says a phenome fricatives.
phenome fricatives.
Yeah, it's a quick rereading proved it to be a surprisingly brilliant satire on Tolkien's linguistic and mythic structures, filled with little take-ups on its use of North tales and wicked phenome fricatives.
Phenome fricatives.
Yeah, I had to look that up.
Sounds like a tasty. The dinner, phenome fricatives.
Well, it's linguistics, so it's, yeah.
Yeah.
Phenomes are the difference of when you say V or B,
uh-huh.
Like that.
Oh, okay.
And, what was it, the phenomes are like the enunciation, the V and the B, and the fricatives are the nasal sounds where you, like, S, like that. I don't know exactly what they were saying. I think they were just throwing that around.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
Yeah.
Okay, there are four words about why they ripped off the Lord of the Rings.
and then we go on to...
So does Border of the Rings tell the whole four books, or just part of it?
It kind of jams most of the first book in there.
The Fellowship.
Because it's concerning...
That's the best book. In some ways, that's my favorite.
Or is it more about the Hobbit, really? There's elements of it all in there, really.
Yeah. They knew their Tolkien.
Yeah, I think they had their Tolkien down. Plus, they said they needed to make some money fast.
Oh, okay.
So that's why they wrote this.
And they probably figured they weren't going to get a big, no one's going to publish a thousand page book of it.
It's a prologue concerning bogies. Bogies is what they call hobbits. This book is predominantly concerned with making money, and from its pages a reader may learn much about the character and literary integrity of the authors. Of bogies, however, he will discover next to nothing, since anyone in the possession of a mere moiety of his marbles will readily concede that such creatures could only exist in the minds of children who grow up to be muggers, dog thieves, and insurance salesmen. Nonetheless, judging from the sales of Professor Tolkien's interesting books, this is a rather sizable group, sporting the kind of scorch marks on their pockets that only come from the spontaneous combustion of heavy wads of money. For such readers, we have collected here a few bits of racial slander concerning bogies, culled by placing Professor Tolkien's books on the floor in a neat pile and going over them countless times in a series of skips and short hops. From then, we will also include a brief description of the soon-to-be-published If This Incredible Dog Sells account of Dildo Bugger's earlier adventurers called by him Travels with Golem in Search of the Lower Middle Earth, but wisely renamed by the publisher Valley of the Trolls. Right. They kind of get into some stereotype here a little bit about the bogies. It's probably is not exactly PC today, but it's still kind of fun. Bogies are unattractive but annoying people whose numbers have decreased rather precipitously since the bottom fell out of the fairy tale market. Slow in soul and yet dull, they prefer to lead simple lives of pastoral squalor. They don't like machines more complicated than a garrote, a blackjack, or a luger, and have always been shy of the big folk, or the biggerers, as they call us.
The biggerers.
As a rule of thumb, they now avoid us except on rare occasions when 100 or so will get together to dry gulch a lone farmer or a hunter. They are little people, smaller than dwarves, who consider them puny, sly, and inscrutable, and often refer to them as the bogey peril. They seldom exceed 3 feet in height, but are fully capable of overpowering creatures half their size when they get to drop on them. As the bogies of the sty, whom we are chiefly concerned, they are unusually drab, dressing in shiny gray suits with narrow lapels, alpine hats, and string ties. Oh. They wear no shoes, and they walk on a pair of hairy, blunt instruments, which can only be called feet because of their approximations. Their faces have a pimply malevolence that suggests a deep-seated fondness for making obscene telephone calls, and when they smile, there is something in the way that they wag their foot-long tongues that makes Komodo dragons gulp with disbelief. But, yeah, it's pretty fun.
This one's called Wage Slave 2. Part of a growing series. This is as an alternative to the more classic stuff. I woke with a throbbing ankle and a need to piss. I hoped she slept still beside me. That day a boss had asked, "What are you worth to my company? Bring me a list." A man less smart than sharp, amused by his own occasional bursts of modesty, once a soldier, 20 years and 50 fewer pounds ago. My ankle throbbed and I needed to piss, and I didn't want to wake her. She hadn't been sleeping well. I lay close, shock and anger mingled closer. Did they meet at my ankle? How could that be? I finally rose for a pain pill and a piss out the day. Walked fine. She shifted and mumbled her concern. Nothing. A piss in the dark is a low thing of beauty. I knew you'd like that line. More relieving than the pill. I didn't sleep for a long time, my mind pummeling the old argument between now, tomorrow, and eternity. The first is mine, second to the boss, and eternity to something like that long piss, and my wish to keep a loved one in her peace.
Yeah, kind of do both.
The celestial. The celestial is nearing, is breathing, is moving in lights. The heated torso, however draped, however slept with daylight and polity, is clue, in arch and curve, to celestial, what shines by lawless music. I wonder how the chains instruct their own release, how a turn or a wrench in that other direction, and how freedom bleeds, how freedom flows, how the celestial was never the treasure held in secret. Still and ever. Nothing learned yet. Though the gurus and kings will speak by fires and drums, will line their platforms with 1,000 naked torsos, point to strange worlds coming, where virtue fuels and starlight reigns, nothing learned yet. Flesh is hunger. This is the strange new world. Your king are senses that behold. Your guru is how mind shapes the world as song of your days.
Wait, I mean, I think I got that. I brought me Billy Collins. I picked out a couple different passages I haven't, I don't think I subjected you guys to. I love this guy, though. Fuck, the way he just turns his stuff around, it's just like, you go, what? This was called Nightclub. You are so beautiful, and I am the fool to be in love with you is a theme that keeps coming up in songs and poems. There seems to be no room for variation. I've never heard anyone saying, I am so beautiful, and you are a fool to be in love with me, even though this notion has surely crossed the minds of women and men alike. You are so beautiful, too bad you are a fool, is another one you don't hear. Or, you are a fool to consider me beautiful, that one you will never hear, guaranteed. For no particular reason this afternoon, I'm listening to Johnny Hartman, whose dark voice can curl around the concepts of love, beauty, and foolishness like no one else can. It feels like smoke curling from a cigarette someone left burning on a baby grand piano at around 3 o'clock in the morning. Smoke that billows up into the bright lights while out there in the darkness, some of the beautiful fools have gathered around the table to listen, some with their eyes closed, others leaning forward into the music as if it were holding them up or twirling the loose ice in a glass. Slipping by degrees into that rhythmic dream, yes, there is all this foolish beauty born beyond midnight. There is no desire to go home, especially now when everyone in the room is watching the large man with the tenor sax that hangs from his neck like a golden fish. He moves forward to the edge of the stage and hands the instrument down to me and nods that I should play. So I put the mouthpiece to my lips and blow into it with all my living breath. We are all so foolish, my long bebop solo begins in saying, so damn foolish that we have become beautiful without even knowing it. See how he just fucking just starts it out and he just gets it totally turned around. He makes such good imagery.
He's a fucker.
He's a fucker.
He's a fucker. That's he comes across as a good old boy in some ways.
Oh yeah, but then he's just like,
he's like good old boy with an IQ of 300 or something.
Oh yeah. That's what happens when you get to be poet laureate, right?
Yeah.
Here's this one called Dharma. I love this one because I like dogs.
Right.
The way the dog trots out the front door every morning without his hat or umbrella, without any money or the keys to her doghouse, never fails to fill the saucer of my heart with milky admiration. Who provides a finer example of life without encumbrance? Thoreau in his curtainless hut with a single plate, a single spoon, Gandhi with his staff and his holy diapers. Off he goes into the material world with nothing but her brown coat and her modest blue collar, following only her wet nose, the twin portals of her steady breathing, followed only by the plume of her tail. If only she did not shove the cat aside every morning and eat all of his food, what a model of self-containment she would be. What a paragon of earthly detachment if she were not so eager for a rub behind the ears, so acrobatic in her welcomes, as if I were her god. All right.
It is.
Wow.
Yeah, I just love that. You know, because it's really true. You know, it's like you think about, because I thought about that a lot. It's like, you know, if there was this concept of what you would be in the next life, I was like, you know what I'd like to be if there was such a thing? I'd like to be a dog in, like, a medium-class household where it's put to service. It's not completely a pet. Yeah. It's still a service.
Yeah.
Has all that attention that comes with it.
Yeah.
Might get fed, might not get fed.
Yeah.
I was thinking, that would be the ideal, the second existence.
The world is not ours. In that dream, I was with blood kin on a happy wedding day. Hours unreal to memories. How the mind worries, how it gnaws back. How that day might have turned. It didn't. Everyone's smiling, relieved. Weddings are good days. Here are new poems. The ones since I loved you and you and you. Each one crawling from the previous, from the ugliest hours, the words, the breaks in flesh and hearts. New poems, some to remember, some to mourn. Then a few to simply look on. What next and next, and the possibilities for a long time were few. Breathe in, breathe out. Then new vines along the path, and then many paths. Many paths, new poems, many musics, continuance.
East-West, once I lived here, a small town in a green place, and it was my home and where I loved. Here was here, the rest was there, years and years. Then I moved here for a while, but the borders were fuzzier. I read books and wondered about there and there. Here was still there, but less so. Bleeding, angry, curious, I fled from here to a larger here, a deeper history, and for a while the ways of there and there receded from my steps, then returned as myths, as mountains, as far-stretching horizons. Here shifted and shifted again as though not to settle, but to keep dancing. Now I look over all the heres and decide to move on by returning. An old here beckons new, and I think maybe here is just shorthand for everywhere and nowhere.
My friend Ralph Emerson has been working essay by essay on a book of linguistic essays. He writes about something called phonesthemes. Phonesthemes is the study of how the sound of a word interrelates with its meaning in terms, the sound of a letter interrelates with its, in, like how a lot of different words that start with some one particular letter, how that sort of all comes about.
Right.
Like it might
the,
be.
The process of.
Yeah. J is for Jumping Jack by Ralph H. Emerson. The letter J has three quite unrelated uses. In vocabulary words, J is a signal of up and down motions, as in jiggle and jump. This reflects the letter's physical prototype of the jaw, which moves up and down as we talk and eat, jabbering, joshing, and jawing away. Since this up and down connotation holds true in many far-flung languages, it seems to be the letter's natural job, or at least the natural job of the J sound that we happen to give J in modern English. J has not always had that sound. It used to be pronounced like Y and yes, ya and yes, which greatly influenced the development of its other meanings. For example, well, first is joyousness, as in joke, jovial, jump for joy, and second is that J is our key letter for names. So many boys and girls were named for Christian saints sporting that little letter, especially John, James, and Joseph, that, well, so many, that J names rhetorically have come to mean average, as in Jane Doe and Joe Schmo. In fiction, such names often suggest heroic averageness, Jane Eyre, James Bond. Not many villains have J names. It's a pretty positive letter, except where Jaws are concerned. Jaws was a shark movie, Jaws was a James Bond villain, and Lewis Carroll chose a J name for his toothiest villain, Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that, that catch. Jump. First, a comparison. The sound most familiar to J is ch. Most similar to J is ch, as in chew. Listen, juju, choo-choo. They're both mouthy sounds, and they overlap a little in meaning. To jabber is to talk fast, so's chattering. If you're cold, your teeth chatter. Shaking from fear, you're jittery with the jim-jams. Shaking from age, you're juddering or juddering. Busy jaws are the image here. Our teeth are choppers chopping away. Jab-jab is chopping up in Australian gunyandi. We eat by stuffing our cheeks and chewing. Talking is chin music. Such words flow into each other. Chin is cousin to Norwegian kin, or cheek. Cheek once meant jaw, and jaw is from French, jou, or cheek. Chin,
chew, chomp, chips, chocolate, chomp, chow, chortle, chug-a-lug, Cheerios, Cheetos, Chiclets. The difference between... I've heard him read these essays. He does it much better than I, but at least I'm doing serviceably. The difference between Ch's mouth imagery and J's is that the Ch words only seem to be able to name literally mouthy things like chewing, while J words are capable of soaring aloft into other realms. So while J makes jaw and jabber, it also names other bouncy things like jumps, juggles, jounces, jumbles, jigs, jitterbugs, and jazz, which was originally slang for sex. All kinds of J things bob up and down. Joggers, jelly, jigsaws, carjacks, burglars, jimmies, jack-in-the-boxes, girls jiggling jugs. Many languages use J verbs for bouncing. Gunyandi jar is to stamp your feet, and jawawar is to jump in the water. Jar Jar Binks. Indonesian jingkolet is to tumble into the water. Jingkik is to hop along. A jingkerik is a cricket. Jingkrak is to jump up and down. And jingkek is literally to jump for joy, like jaku yaku in Japanese. While J motions must be quick, must go in a jiffy, they need not only be up and down. They can also go quickly up or out, as in jab, jut, a jet of water, or be the impact from such juttings, jar, jostle, jerk, jolt, jam. Sometimes they are side-to-side movements. Indonesian jangkat, jangkit, is to wobble. Gunyandi jinjin is to shake a tree. They can be noisy, too, especially in bell words like jingle and jangle. Native Japanese for a bell's jangling is janjan, and Chinese for bell, zhong, is pronounced zhong. Okay. If you look up the history of the various jumpy English words above, it usually says etymology unknown. Ja is a medium-rare round in the world's languages. It's entirely absent from the Germanic tongues that English came from, so our jumpy words didn't come from there. Our ja sound came from Norman French, but French didn't give us many jumpies either, because it never had many of its own. Our jumpies mostly arose within English itself, bubbling up from our collective unconscious with appropriate meanings as soon as we had a ja sound to work with. The most obscure English dialects often have perfect J words known nowhere else. Leafing through Wright's English Dialect Dictionary, which is definitely something my friend here will do. He will leaf through dialect dictionaries.
Nice.
I find half a dozen old regional equivalents of jolt, including jarg, jazz, jet, jot, jud, jollick, juff, and jow. All of those loosely meant shove or jostle. That last word, jow, is especially interesting since it's really nothing but a J with a vowel tacked on to make it pronounceable. And its definitions obediently cycle through each J specialty. Talk aloud, knock strike, a jolt a jog, rock roll, move forward in a rocking way, and ring or toll a bell. Mm. What's that? Yeah, yeah. Joy. Merry bells also ring in l'allegro. L'allegro. John Milton's poem about joy. A few lines later, he's watching youths and maids dancing to jocund fiddles in checkered shade as he waits for his muse. Milton chose sounds carefully to set the moods in his poems, and he knew that J words were as lively as ringing bells and breathless dancers. The jocund fiddles were no accident either. The word is from jocus, Latin for joke, and thus an etymological cousin to many other playful words, including jocular, jocose.
It's like a conspiracy with words.
Yeah. The French word jeu, or game, and even those little game pieces called jewels and jewelry. So while jocular is no relation to joy, from Latin gaudium, or to jolly, jovial, jubilant, or jubilant, it's certainly on the same team. Same with jesting. The J's in jocular and joke helped attract unrelated words like jest, josh, hijinks, mischief, and their buddies, jape, or practical joke, jibe, and jeer. Such words often cluster together, the jests and jeers of others, continuing to joke, jape, or jest at the expense of others. Most European tongues share a few of them with us, Spanish jocoso, Dutch jolig, and so on. And we also find counterparts beyond Europe. Japanese borrowed joku from us, but it already had the native word jodan for joke, as well as jara jara for playful, and the verbs jaru and jarasu for playing. I'm cheating here.
Oh.
The letter J in Japanese and other non-Western tongues has more or less the same just sound as in English, but the local J in most European languages never sounds like ours, even in familiar-looking words. French jacquand is jacquand, Spanish jacosa is jocoso, and the jolly Dutch jolig is jolik. In contrast to our jump and jiggle, which get their up and down meanings directly from their just sounds, the J-ness of international mood words like jolly and jocular rests almost entirely in the written letter, not in any particular sound, because the J takes on different sounds as it crosses national borders. J's earliest sound, its original sound in Latin, this is good stuff. See? Cheering. I like that. J's earliest sound, its original sound in Latin, which is still used in Dutch and German, is J. There's a relic of this in the word hallelujah, where the Latin letters J are pronounced J, exactly like the Dutch and German ja 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 for yes, or indeed like Yah in Yahweh, the Hebrew name for God Almighty. Hallelujah is Hebrew for praise the Lord, so the early Roman Christians who pronounced the J as Yah naturally spelled it Jah. J-H. Did you catch that? Because chances are that you or someone you love has a J in their name for exactly the same reason.
Let's see. Someone got any J's?
Yeah.
Jason.
Well, one of my brother's middle name is Jeffrey. Do you even have any middle names, Jay?
No
Jays. Okay. Well, we have Jason. Is that?
That's right.
That's brother.
No, that's me. Middle name.
Your middle name is Jason?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Well, this hit close to home here. He's practically looking you in the eyeballs.
He's bringing it all home.
And he's seeing inside your soul, man. That's true. And he's.
That's Jan. This is Jason.
Well, I'm just saying,
taking it personal.
I'm trying to root around in the head of anybody with a J. I don't know where.
Well, my friend, let's see. I have my friend Jim Burke.
Oh, you know lots of
J's. I know Joe Saccone. Oh my gosh, Judah Haydick. Hey, guy. Wow, that's a lot of J's.
Catfish Rivers, his actual name is
Jeremy. Yeah.
He's a J Conspirator.
Oh my gosh, I'm part of the plot. Welcome, my brother.
Cornucopia J's over in Raymond's head. Oh, his camps.
Jack and Jill. In these articles, we often note the sexes of certain initials. T and L as in Tom and Lily, M as in Mary, and now J as in John. The M and J traditions are part of our Christian heritage. Historically, all female M names recall the Virgin Mary, and J names recall Jesus. But since Jesus seemed too sacred to bandy about as a boy's name, custom seized instead on John from his associate John the Baptist, the Apostle, and the Evangelist. After the Crusades, says the Oxford Dictionary of English Christian Names, another book he casually leaps through, Europeans named John a favorite name in all its local forms, French Jean, German Hans from Johannes, Italian Giovanni, Spanish Juan, Russian Ivan. Well, that's cool. How popular was it? Here are some statistics. For 2.5 centuries after 1550, the tally of English boys baptized John never dipped below 15%. In the decades before 1700, it peaked at an astonishing 28%. At as late as 1930, it was still the most popular boy's name in America. And it's also the source of Jones and Johnson, the two commonest surnames after Smith. Besides being a euphemism for Jesus, what does John have to do with Yahweh? Well, it is one of many names in which the God-drunk Hebrews use the godly syllable Yah. In its Hebrew form, John meant God is gracious, or Yohanan. When Roman Christians used the name, they wrote it with J, like hallelujah, so the Hebrew Yohanan became Latin Johannes. As Latin disappeared, each new language evolved its own way of saying the J, giving us our modern bouquet of sounds in John and Juan and Jean. Several names have parallel stories. God shall add a son was Joseph, later Joseph, and God of salvation was Yeshua, Latinized in Rome as Jesus. These J names easily cross the gender line from male to female, far more so than M names go the other way. Male Matthews and Michaels abound, and a few Catholic-born European men like Rainer Maria Rilke have always been named for the Virgin, but they were never remotely as common as female Marias. Yet John feminizes very easily in female forms. In English are Jane, Joan, Jean, and Jeannie, Janice, Janet. Other tongues have Johanna, Juanita, Ivana, Jana, Jean.
These have always been exceedingly popular. In Paris around 1300, says the dictionary above, John, or Jihan or John, was at least twice as frequent as the next name William. Ho-hum. But is it really shocking that Jane was twice as common as Marie? Then as now, John and Mary shared the stage with John and Jane and many other 2J couples, Jim and Judy in Rebel Without a Cause, Joe and Jane Sixpack, the average Joe and Jill, and Jack and Jill in the nursery rhyme. The last two names were so common, they turned into vocabulary words. Jill or Jillian, Latin Juliana, was used as a slang for girl from Shakespeare to Three Jills in a Jeep. I think porn movie. We took Jack from French Jock, Latin Jacobus, Hebrew Yaakov, conflated it with John, and used it for Guy, Jack of all trades, Cracker Jack, Jack-o'-lantern, same in fiction whose Jacks are all regular guys from Jack and the Beanstalk to Jack Bauer, Jack Reacher and Titanic's poor Jack Dawson. Jack's female counterpart is Jacqueline or Jackie. To be sure, Jack's source Jacob did not come from Yahweh. Not every Hebrew J name is from Yahweh, nor every J name from Hebrew. Jill's source Juliana is from the utterly Roman Julius, but the early popularity of biblical J names like John gave the Western world a lasting fondness for names of that letter, whatever their origins, and for boys and girls alike, Jaspers and Jodies and Jasmines and so on. One recent baby name book called itself Beyond Jennifer and Jason. It seemed... Yeah.
It needs to be beyond.
It's dipping below 15%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems entirely right that Ian Fleming and Molière called their heroes James Bond and Monsieur Jordan, and even alliterative Jack Jordans scarcely make us blink. Scarcely. J is the name letter. It inspires confidence, even as a mere initial. Have you ever bought clothes from J Press, J Cruel, J Crew, J Jill, or J Peterman? That's where the name J comes from. You spelled out sound of the initial. Most famously in the case of Jimmy Gatz, the farm boy who remade himself as Fitzgerald's J. Gatsby. No other letter has been designated a name in its own right, except perhaps K. And it seems to enjoy cloning itself. Friends of my grandparents had four daughters, Judith, Janice, Joyce, and Gerianne. The narrator of Martin Amis's book Money dreams along the same lines. Oh, this tube of chicks, those Junes, Jans, Jones, Jens, Jeans, and Janes. And who is he? I'm called John Self, but who isn't? YJ, here's the climactic finale. After exploring how we use the letter J, it remains to ask why we use it as we do. I don't fully understand it myself, but here's a rough idea. It's technical, but stay with me. English spelling really mismanages the two sounds we write as J and Ch. Our Ch is really shush. I'll show you. This is why you got to be reading this. I'll show you. Say shoe, then add T. Chew, compress it and you get chew. And J in jaw is similarly a D plus ZH, as in, well, say grad, then gradual, and you hear the duh turn into j, grudge, gradual. That's RJ sound. In effect, J and cha are blurred D and T sounds, gradual virtue. If you absorbed that, here's the payoff. As I've written elsewhere, T and D respectively indicate up and down, as in stand tall, strive, and drop deep down. Since the reasons for this are perfectly organic, tongue position and presence or lack of vocal cord vibration, it makes sense to designate rapid up and down movement with blurred versions of those same letters.
That's funny. I have to enunciate gradual. I have to make it conscious. I have to go gradual.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it comes out all mush.
Gradual.
Yeah.
Gradual. To spring up is thus not dump or tump, but jump. To eat with a moving jaw is not to, but chew. The busy jaw is not a daw, but a jaw. Not every language does it this way. Somali has lots of J words, for instance, but there's nothing remotely jumpy or jaw-like in any of them, and many languages lack a J sound entirely. Still, if we want to rationalize the letters up and down, the letters up and down, its phonetic connection with the up and down specialists, T and D, seems like a good place to start. I noticed that in the Nigerian Tiv, where jump is tisu and jaw is jigrig, ordinarily pronounced j, but in some cases amplified to
jigrig,
chump. But J is versatile, even versatile to the point of confusion. Not only can D blur into
je, so can y. This has happened several times. Many Spanish speakers now say the pronoun yo, like Joe, yo becoming Joe. Latin speakers in the Dark Ages spontaneously did the same thing with Y words like jocus, which went from yocus to jocus. Our joke and John began with je because of a silly 1,500-year-old fashion. If not for that quirk, we'd all still be saying yoke and yon. Oh, John, okay. Yoke and yon, like Swedish tourists. And that is, in fact, the best way to understand those kinds of J words, to think of them as Y words. Y is infinitely jovial, a letter of exuberance. Yay, yippee, yippee-yay. Talking is yakking, laughs are yucks, and cheerful yelling means parties ahead.
Cheerful yelling.
Yeah. German, Jaschen, yauk, means both to cheer and to celebrate, exactly like jubilare, or jubilare, in Latin, the source of our jubilant. Yoo-hoo! Yee-haw! Yahoo! People all over the world making those jolly Y noises when they're celebrating, like out there. And even if they're worshipping, too. Devotees of Bacchus, the god of wine, used to make so much noise in their revelries, yah-yah-yah-yah-yah, that the Greeks gave Bacchus the nickname Yakis. That's absolutely true. I'm not speculating there. Some scholars think that Yahweh got his name the same way. The Bible is vague about this, but because Yahweh looks something like the Hebrew word yieh, he is, Jewish scribes like to explain it as a variant of the verb to be. In the burning bush story in Exodus 3:14, when Moses asks God who he is, God answers, "Tell them I am sent you." Ayah. I'm relying here on G.R. Driver, who wrote the article on Yahweh's, anglicized from form Jehovah, for the 1962 Encyclopedia Britannica.
See, I heard one time somebody said the assemblage of letters for Yahweh was actually meant to be unpronounceable.
Yeah. So you couldn't, yeah. The Exodus story is thrilling, but Driver notes that earlier inscriptions and traditions give God's entire name as the single syllable Yah, which was probably ejaculatory in origin. Compare Greek Bacchus and Iacchus, for Yah or Yah is a common Semitic exclamation. As I said, Y is the letter of exuberance. If modern scholars are right, the name gradually evolved from the meaningless Yah to the significant Yahweh, by a prolongation of the ejaculation natural in moments of emotion or excitement. Its eventual assimilation to an explanation by a simple verb was an act of inspiration. Isn't that nice? If God's name is a cheer, we're cheering every time we say one of our own J names aloud. Hey, Jim. Hey, Jen. Yeehaw! I'm going to read it's a relatively self-contained passage from the story I've been working on for 4 years called Labyrinthine. It was a story Bowie told Krista one night, one he told Greta on another night years back, and the difference between the two stories was something, maybe everything. He says, "I was coming off a bad case, a really bad one. Murder, betrayal, the common good defended in the worst possible way. I was on leave, a long one. Nobody knew for sure if I'd be back. But I'd sacrifice things in this case, dear things, some you only get once in the first place and don't usually get back. I was a drinker then, and maybe the worst kind. I'd go on holy mission drunks, look for God in the worst places. I had this idea that it was only in the worst and best of the world that anything holy might appear to me. Pain and beauty are both experienced as a kind of suffering." The story up to this point was pretty much the same, though with Greta he drank red wine, and with Krista he smoked a fine blunt. Greta matched him glass for glass. Krista loved ganja as much as anything, but she took a little coaxing with it. I lived in a city for a while. Got to know its alleys, the parks where the cops let the bums stay a while, the beat restaurants and coffee shops. I'd been there long enough to have something of a separate identity in these places. I needed it sometimes, and then, after a while, needed to get back to my pay job. I even had a few buddies down and out. They knew little about me. I let a fractured narrative grow up about an alcoholic, used to be a lawyer maybe, now disabled, maybe a little bit sick, something like that. The next party told Greta, not Krista, the wine slowed him a bit, the ganja hurried him along, no real explaining that. Some of my buddies had seen real hard times. One had been in the military, the Marines, he claimed, but he was proud and haunted by it both. That's putting it wrong. Another had done some jail time for some violent things. Now he was old and tired, not much flared up his old temper. We'd meet and drink coffee, and I'd spike our drinks with cheap whiskey, and most of it was bullshit, which suited me fine, but sometimes a word hits a nerve, and someone goes off. Old blood spill is fucking happening again. It's happening now. Sometimes it was just the place in the night. There was one park where you could get a clear view of the stars. I don't know, there weren't many street lamps near or something. And we'd sit there drinking a jug of Dago Red I got us, sipping it really, by the hour, letting it ride us through the night. We'd have our sleeping rolls and jackets, talking, and sometimes not talking. And some cops would hassle us, and some wouldn't. They had their moods and bad nights like anyone else. And the stories weren't much, mostly. Usually about things we didn't have and wanted. Women, good food, better health, a bed to sleep in that wasn't a residence, hotel, or shelter. Greta nodded and said nothing. Her hometown, Seattle, had its population of homeless and poor. She could see Bowie hunkered down among them, finding something there the rest of his life. One guy told a story of how he lost his wife, and every time he told it, we'd end up arguing over it. He said it wasn't natural what happened, how she should have survived that fire, but how the fire should have never started in the first place, how it wasn't his fault or her fault, but it damn well was somebody or something's fault. He was sure of that. Greta and Kristen both get to hear this, Krista and both get to hear the story, but Krista's alternatively begins, "I knew a guy once who told me, and somebody's a story," and so on. He said they lived in New Mexico, a little town in the desert where she was from and where he moved to when they got married. They'd met on a Greyhound bus and traveled till they had no money or options left but to go home, her home, marry and set up shop. He'd pause. Greta nodded again, a good listener. Krista would nod too, but impatient. His stories made her restless and uncertain. Maybe it was the ganja. So they came home, and it took a while to explain to everyone in town who and what he was. Her family was willing enough, figuring she was bound soon for catting it up. Might as well have a ring on. Colting it up. Might as well have a ring on. He knew enough about fixing cars during the week and when to kneel and sing at Mass on Sunday to find a shallow place in things. They had a small house. She kept it clean, and he worked part-time at her uncle's garage, fixing cars while his uncle drank tequila and worked on his system for beating the lotto system. I don't even know if New Mexico has a lottery. Always meant to look it up. Wouldn't be too hard to find out. I could just imagine this uncle drinking tequila and trying to crack the lottery system. The lotto. Greta laughs, pours them more wine. Krista says nothing, listens restlessly. They were Spanish people. These were Spanish people, full of that ribald piety people get when... Ribald piety, Greta snorts. Yeah, they live close to God, but like you would a tribal father. There are moments when God's creation just seemed ridiculous to them. Ridiculous how? Asked Krista. Greta just nodded. They'd drink hard some Saturday nights. The preacher would show up sometimes, and once in a while he'd take his fill of wine, and the talk would turn to God. God in sex, God in drink, God in the government. Sometimes the preacher would say something and everyone would fall down. Bowie nodded like that was that. He wouldn't talk about the UFOs, though. Not a word. They'd try. Why couldn't Jesus come back in a spaceship? Isn't that better than an ET invasion? They're there, Padre. You've seen them as much as any of us. Jesus, spaceship. If he was drinking his share, the Padre would nod, mumble a prayer. Once he said, whatever they are, they fly in God's skies and come from God's stars. They are God's strange angels. If he was sober, he would fuss around the picnic tables on the edge of town, where we would gather with our jugs and homemade tortillas. He would growl about our lapses to attend church, or our obvious hangovers. The night it happened was a windy one, high and dusty winds, everyone indoors before dusk, nothing visible. My friend would insist every single time that Rosie had not gone out, had stayed in with him and their cats. He would begin to yell, and we had to calm him down just to get him to go on, because he would go on. He had to tell it. It was the only story he cared about, and nothing since had mattered. Greta nodded, sipped. Krista would take Bowie's hand, hope the story would be quick. It was too spooky and the ganja was very strong. But in the morning, they found him with the door wide open, and it was easy to see by all the dust and scatter that it had been opened during the storm. The morning was clear, sunny, like no dust storms had ever existed. But Rosie was gone. Bowie nodded to himself, mostly. Paul could barely talk. His clothes were filthy. He wasn't drunk, but he wasn't right. Finally, he started in. Was she mad? Did she walk out to cool off? You two fight sometimes. No, it was a peaceful night. I fell asleep in that armchair right there. She was reading one of her science magazines. We had the radio on. I was tired, lightheaded. I didn't tell her. It was nothing. I fell asleep watching the storm, the way it clouded our window. Look at that window. That was all. I fell asleep. Rosie was reading. The police in town investigated. No signs of blood or a fight. Nothing. Her clothes and books were in their spots. Half the town walked right into the desert, calling and looking for clues. Krista is too high for anymore. She touches his arm. He smiles. Greta nods, sips, listens. Paul didn't say anything strange for months. He didn't say much at all. Rosie's family surrounded him with love and comfort. He loved their Rosie as much as they had. All were bounded forever in this sorrow. There was a parting. Months had gone by. It was high school graduation, and the town was ready to ease up. A lot of tension rode through it, the kind only singing and dancing and wine foolishness under a great big moon can help to cure. When Paul showed up, neatly dressed, smiling, the night seemed totally blessed. Rosie had a cousin, Paula, and everyone but Paul knew that Paula had a crush on him. She wasn't pushy, and she knew nobody really thought anything would happen. Paula was leaving the town, going to college. People figured she'd move along. But Paula wasn't what people thought, and in truth, she knew Paul better than anyone else in the town. It happened by accident. After a week or so of looking and calling, the search for Rosie dwindled. Nobody said it to Paul, but everyone assumed she was gone. It was a time to mourn, to accept. Out of respect for him, people gave him his space, murmured their grief to each other in private. Paula knew more than anybody did. She had seen Rose that afternoon, knew Rosie was going and might not return. She told nobody, but she looked at Paul secretly in those early days and felt wild with guilt. She couldn't have told him where she was, but she could have told him more than anyone else knew. Paula spent a lot of time in the desert. Her obligations to high school were fewer. Teachers were assured of her future and let her have her extra time. She wasn't dating anyone, so none of the adults in her life worried. Paula was alone one afternoon, wandering the scrub and cacti when she saw Paul. He was a distance from her, crouched down, still, maybe in deep thought. She wanted to leave him be, knew that that would be best, but she knew from giggling nights with Rosie what kind of man he was. She knew if he would ever look at her, her smooth body under clunky clothes meant to keep boys away, listen to her thoughts, the books she read and could quote and add to, he would want to take her. She knew this without obsessing on it. Her trick that year was to fake a schoolgirl crush on him for the town's satisfaction, while bearing a woman's quiet, erotic rush for him that nobody knew. He was not a man to notice much less act on a schoolgirl crush, so even as she approached him, waving her hand awkwardly to get his attention, her real attraction was hidden safely between swaths of deception. He didn't look up, but nodded at her. She'd never been alone with him. She felt light. Greta suggested they take a walk outside. She was cramped and feeling loopy. The story had amused her, involved her, now it was starting to bother her. The sky was a dark bath of bright lights, and Greta lit up a hookah pipe as they sat on her porch, third floor of an apartment building in the hills, a few miles outside the city. The city was noise and movement distantly below. Bowie sucked the pipe twice and resumed telling. He asked her what books she had with her. She started inside and looked at her thin volumes like they were poisonous creatures, then cohered. Nothing. Research. They're not even really books. They're articles I sent away for, and they came in binders. He didn't look up. Paula wondered if she should leave. She didn't want to. She really didn't want to. I have an interest in science. That's going to be my major next fall. Why? Why? Nobody asked that. Why? Fuck. Because I'm a geek girl? Because of this loco shit that happens out here, she heard herself say. He looked up. He smiled. She felt like a goofy kid. Yeah, I've been wondering about that, too. It was clumsy talk at first. Their connection was rosy, but not a word about her. Paul didn't ask easy questions. After a while, he just talked, eventually about Rosie. Something's out here. I've known that since I lived here. Something live, and it's not human. But I don't know what that makes it. When I first met Rosie, before we even talked on the bus, I saw her reading a book. She told me it was alternative history. She said you hear the same old shit from hippies and Indians and UFO nuts. It was like people thought they were onto something when they weren't. They were mouthing what everyone else was saying. I asked myself, okay, how do I break this? Where do my ideas... How do I break this? How do my ideas come from here, her head, and in here, her heart, not from someone else? Paula listened and said nothing. Paul smiled, a devilish half-smile. When she pointed to her heart, I let myself look at her chest, and then I blushed like a nut. She smiled back. It's okay. You're wired to like them. I nodded but didn't look again. She had leaf-shaped earrings. I watched them. I asked her what alternative history meant. Isn't that like science fiction or New Age? She moved across the aisle to my seat, tucked herself right in. Maybe, man. I mean, you could say that. I thought she would say more, but she started telling me about her town here. This town is small, but it's on the edge of this big desert. I've been out there since I was little. The people in town say UFOs fly over at night. They're spooked. They spook their kids. They make up stories to be spooked even more. They wish the town was like Roswell. I never believed any of it. Do you know why? Dreams. Paul quotes Rosie saying, and here's Paula quoting her too. The words echo between them. They look at each other. She was my cousin. We were close. He nodded. The moment passed, but didn't. Everything that happened from then on echoed that moment when they revealed to each other what they both knew.